BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Shahid Abari, and I'm delighted to be introducing this short talk recorded at BBC Radio 3's Free Thinking Festival as a BBC Arts and Ideas podcast. Ian Smith spends his time at the University of London studying film, with a particular interest in world cinema and international superheroes, from the Turkish Superman to the Philippines films where Batman fights with James Bond. He's a new generation thinker on the scheme the BBC runs with the Arts and Humanities Research Council to make radio programmes from academic research. And his talk today is called Should Salman Rushdie Live and Let Die?
It's 1990. You are an examiner for the British Board of Film Classification. It's your job to watch the latest releases and decide what age certificate is appropriate. Earlier this year, you gave a 15 rating to Pretty Woman and a PG to Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And you've just received a new film from Pakistan called International Guerrillas. As with many South Asian films, it's nearly 3 hours long. It mixes together elements of the action, comedy, romance, and musical genres. And it has a wonderfully over-the-top villain whom the audience is encouraged to hate. On first glance, then, it seems fairly unremarkable. But then something catches your attention. The villain in this film is named Salman Rushdie. And our heroes are a trio of Islamist guerrilla fighters who are inspired by Ayatollah Khomeini's fatwa to try to track down and kill Rushdie. Not only that, but you're watching this film at the height of the controversy surrounding the publication of Rushdie's novel, The Satanic Verses, and the numerous calls worldwide for the book to be banned. We're only 4 months after Iranian clerics have again reiterated the fatwa on Salman Rushdie's life for having written the novel, and Rushdie himself is still in hiding. What would you do if you were that film examiner? Would you allow a film to be released that seemingly endorses the killing of a specific living British citizen? Would you somehow be partly responsible if Rushdie were to be subsequently murdered by someone who watched the film? On the other hand, what if you banned the film? Would this be an act of censorship akin to those who had originally called for the banning of Rushdie's novel? Would it not be the ultimate irony that Rushdie, the great advocate for freedom of expression, is used as the justification for the banning of a work of art? Most films submitted to the BBFC are watched by just two examiners, but this decision was so impossible to make that they asked 24 examiners to weigh in on the decision, and then had one of the most heated and tempestuous debates in their history. Today, though, the film is almost completely forgotten. It's seen as little more than a bizarre footnote to the wider Satanic Verses affair. But I've been going through the British Board of Film Classification's archives to look again at the reports written by those 24 examiners. And what I found there is really quite remarkable. On one level, this was simply a debate about whether to allow this particular film to be released in the UK. But on another level, it was also a broader debate about the purpose of censorship within a contemporary multicultural society. Where do we draw the line in freedom of expression? Who gets to decide? What might be the justification for the banning of a novel or a film? Would we ban something that we personally find offensive? Or that we feel has the potential to cause harm within society? Might the act of censorship itself cause greater harm in the long run? Questions that are, of course, still very relevant nearly 30 years later. So let's dig a bit deeper into those reports to see what they tell us. As one examiner explains, the film created a problem for the BBFC for two reasons. He says, firstly, there is a real death sentence against Salman Rushdie, which on entering its second year has been reiterated by the Islamic leaders of Iran. And secondly, the crux of the plot reveals a boozing Islam hater and psychopathic killer of Muslims who, although laughable and born of inspiration from the villains of James Bond movies, is, unfortunately, named Salman Rushdie. Those who wish to pass the film without any changes generally argued that the film was so laughable in its style that no one could take it seriously. After all, this is a James Bond-style spy thriller featuring a series of disco-themed musical numbers. When one character is captured, their torture is having to listen to passages being read out from the satanic verses. Were they really going to ban a film that they themselves felt was patently ridiculous? As one examiner explains, this James Bond is simply too feeble, too full of stock characters to represent the gross libel that has been ascribed to it. Surely a sophisticated man like Mr. Rushdie would laugh at the portrait of himself in this film. Even the most extreme scenes within the film, such as when Rushdie is shown killing guerrilla fighters and then sniffing their blood, are still portrayed in a heightened, almost camp performance style. This couldn't be taken seriously, could it? And interestingly, this was a position supported by the film's producer, Sajjad Goel, who argued at the time that, to me, it's a satire on the whole issue. If it had been made in England or America, it would have been made by Mel Brooks. That's how people should view it. Yet for many of the examiners, the fact that the film was laughable in many ways was irrelevant to their decision. Because ultimately, this was a film that seemingly endorsed the fatwa against Rushdie, and they were concerned about their culpability in allowing that film to be released. As one examiner asks, if Salman Rushdie should be killed after the release of this video, will it be a result of the video? Will our hands be bloody? Remember, at this time, Rushdie was living under protection from the UK government. This was only a year after the book burnings of the Satanic Verses in Bolton and Bradford. What effect might the screening of this film have within this already extremely sensitive and turbulent situation? A real concern for the examiners then was what effect this film could have on an audience member who was already radicalized. As a report explains, what if this one hypothetical zealot is rekindled by the piece to take action? What if this finally affords him the confirmation he's been waiting for? What if this is the last nod of approval, the last straw that tips the scales? This is the one time where our decision at the board is going to concretely matter. We cannot pass this film, or we are in peril of not only being appallingly hypocritical, but cowardly as well. Another examiner agreed. He said, this issue looks awfully clear to me. This is a man's life. For the examiners arguing for the film to be banned then, there was a clear anxiety that passing the film would mean that the British Board of Film Classification was indirectly endorsing the fatwa against Rushdie's life, and that it might actually inspire someone to carry it out. However, there was one aspect of the film which they felt might mitigate that threat. In International Guerrillas, the Islamist heroes don't actually kill Rushdie. Instead, in the final scene, three flying Qurans, the Islamic holy book, float down from the sky and fire lightning bolts at Rushdie, killing him. As one of the examiners explains, the film's only saving grace is that the final message seems to be, leave it to Allah to kill Rushdie for you. Just pray. Not much of a mitigation, but at least we don't see the guerrillas carrying out the fatwa. So, taking this ending into consideration, most of the examiners voted for the film to be released. And if it had been based on a majority decision, that would have been the case. But those examiners were soon overruled by legal advice that the film might constitute criminal libel after all. And some of the examiners found this quite frustrating, to say the least. One said, I hardly had time to consider the complex issues involved before the senior lawyer's conclusions thumped down like a fatwa. If anything, this strengthened me in the direction of wanting to pass the piece, but at the same time, obviates my advice. As in the past, we are grateful to an unchallenged notion of the law coming in like a deus ex machina and relieving us of the whole delicate and unwelcome business. The decision then was taken out of their hands, and many examiners were relieved, even if they felt that this was ultimately the wrong choice. But the examiners who were most upset with the decision were those who had strongly argued for its release based on the principles of freedom of expression. Could they really ban a film in the name of Salman Rushdie, given that much of the original controversy stemmed from the calls to ban his novel? One of the examiners saw this as a particularly hypocritical position for them to take. He said, "By banning this video, we have acted as intolerantly as those who demanded Rushdie's death." Nevertheless, despite these objections, the film was refused a certificate and effectively banned in the UK, but only for a month. Because when the distributor took this decision to the Video Appeals Committee, they hired the human rights lawyer, Jeffrey Robertson QC, who was also representing Rushdie at the time. And then Salman Rushdie himself intervened in the case. He wrote, "The truth is that I have more confidence than the BBFC in the ability of the film's audience, non-Muslim as well as Muslim, to recognize this film for the distorted, incompetent piece of trash that it is. And to understand that the Salman Rushdie character is ludicrously unlike the real me. I am in favor of this film being certified for open video sale because I believe that such publication is the surest way of revealing its shabbiness and of preventing it from becoming a cause celeb." As it turned out, he was right. The film won its case at the Appeals Committee, and the distributor organized a UK premiere at the Odeon in Bradford. Hoping to capitalize upon all the controversy, they booked a 1,200-seat cinema. But by this time, pirate VHS copies of the film had been circulating for weeks. So the people that wanted to see the film had already seen it. The premiere was a flop, filling less than a quarter of the seats. And the film soon disappeared after that weekend, largely to be forgotten. So why should we care about this film from 30 years ago? It's certainly no masterpiece of world cinema. While it is available to view on YouTube, I'm not sure that I'd particularly recommend that you watch it. There are much better films from Pakistan out there, and I'm certainly not making the case for this being a neglected classic. But as Salman Rushdie notes in his autobiography, Joseph Anton, the release of the film was an object lesson in the importance of the better out than in free speech argument. That it was better to allow even the most reprehensible speech than to sweep it under the carpet. Better to publicly contest and perhaps deride what was loathsome than to give it the glamour of taboo. And that, for the most part, people could be trusted to tell the good from the bad. In other words, for Rushdie, the greater danger would have come from banning the film and therefore making it the hot video that everyone needs to watch. The film that the UK government won't allow you to see. If the ban had been upheld, it would still have been viewed on pirate VHS anyway, and the notoriety of the ban may well have encouraged more audiences to track it down and watch it. It is worth considering, though, what would have happened if the film hadn't been so ridiculous and laughable in its execution? If it hadn't been the disreputable piece of trash that Rushdie described, but instead a serious endorsement of the fatwa? Because for even the most liberal amongst us, who generally oppose the banning of films, there's still usually a limit. Consider, would you still stand by your principles of freedom of expression if someone produced a film that expressly advocated for your murder? How would you feel about the British Board of Film Classification if they were to allow that film to be released in cinemas? Where would you draw the line?
We'll take some questions from the floor in a moment, but I wanted to ask you how the film was received in Pakistan, because we have a sense of how fraught the conversation was in Britain, but how was it received over there?
It was actually a kind of moderate hit in Pakistan. It wasn't particularly controversial. The producer was designing this as a purely commercial film. As many kind of popular films, kind of exploitation films are, it's kind of capitalizing on a kind of controversial topic in order to draw in an audience. And so it was just a very successful strategy to kind of make the villain called Salman Rushdie, draw in an audience for people who have heard about this controversy. So actually, yeah, it was a hit, but then it was a hit that was soon forgotten about, as many kind of popular commercial films are.
I'm desperate to see Salman Rushdie do a musical number. let's get some questions from the floor, because I'm sure there are some.
Are there any other films that have provoked quite so much soul-wrangling amongst the British Board of Film Classifiers?
Certainly there have been quite a few films that they've decided to ban, and there's been debate internally about what they should do. Around about this time, there was a film called Visions of Ecstasy, which was a kind of short film that was banned partly for the reasons of blasphemy. There's certainly been lots of debate as to whether that is at the time, is that a law that should still be being applied to films being made in the kind of late 1980s? Only a few years earlier, the BBFC had been involved with the banning of a large number of films as the Video Nasties controversy. So there certainly have been lots of films that have been banned for scenes of kind of extreme violence or sex, or blasphemy in the case of Visions of Ecstasy. And there was lots of debate over Last Temptation of Christ as well. But I think this one's quite unique in terms of the particular issues that they were wrestling with around freedom of expression and around that relationship with the satanic verses. Because I think that just heightened that question over what side are they on in terms of whether they would be supportive of a ban of a work of art.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much. That was really interesting. I had a question about systems of meaning. I'm going to try and formulate this question. So one of the main problems that some countries had with the satanic verses was that it deeply offended religious sensibilities, of course, and we know that. And so for them, within that system of meaning, banning the book made sense, like India, for example, and Iran, of course. So when you ask the question, you know, what is your limit? Is this very much a question you're asking within a Eurocentric framework, but within a Western framework? You're saying, what is your limit on freedom of speech? But the question is really for a Western audience, isn't it? So that the way in which the novel generated controversy and banning in certain countries was because of its hitting at the limits of what was acceptable in those systems of belief and meaning.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good question, because it does raise that question of whether we believe that certain kind of enlightenment values of human rights are things that should be aspired for universally, or are kind of culturally particular. And I guess for me, I'm kind of wary of a kind of cultural relativism where I say that within the West, I support freedom of expression, but other countries, they can deal with it the way that they want. I know that there are problems with a kind of, there are so many problems with the kind of Western liberal humanist enlightenment kind of values as a model for the world to adopt. But nevertheless, I do believe in the right to free expression as being a key part of a kind of civilization. And I do feel that that's not limited to a kind of Eurocentric Western perspective, and that it is something that I would want to argue for on a kind of universal global level.
There's a question over there.
Thanks for that. I guess my question is a bit related. You've talked about the film board discussing the film in terms of kind of abstract values of free expression. Is there also evidence that they were worried about, I guess, population management, managing multiculturalism? This is happening at a time where you have newly politicized Asian communities emerging in Britain. Is it all kind of very pure thinking, abstract thinking when it comes to freedom of expression, or are they worried how will different communities react to this, and are we going to, in a sense, stoke the flames? And
Yeah, no, that is another really good question, because they were trying to kind of wrestle with that issue of like, how would particular communities within the UK respond to this film? What are their kind of responsibilities as a kind of board of classification for those communities? But part of what's interesting in the reports is that there's often an acknowledgement that they don't really know, that they have one examiner from Pakistan who then kind of ends up helping to translate the film, explaining various elements. And their own report is really fascinating, because it tries to kind of, they see how that one examiner could be perceived in various ways. Like, are they a kind of westernized figure who is kind of supporting the British Board of Classification in making their decisions? Are they the kind of representative of the British Pakistani community. So actually, the reports are kind of wrestling with a lot of the problems that kind of wider society at that time was kind of dealing with.
Are there any other questions? There's one. Let's take that as our last question, I think.
Thank you. Is this what I would call nanny state intervention relevant when it's only really applicable to commercial films? And as you say, there's very, very few things that are blocked on the internet.
So certainly the internet has changed. Yeah, the fact that we can now watch this film on YouTube very easily. These films are widely available. But then I think the British Board of Film Classification have shifted their policies over the years. They acknowledge that many of the films that were banned earlier, I mentioned earlier, the kind of video nasties controversy, those are now available on DVD. You can go to your local ASDA and buy films that at one point were being, videotapes were actually being encouraged to be burned because they were seen to be so reprehensible. Now you can buy in your local shop. So there is a shift in the kind of access to this material. But nevertheless, I think a film like this still raises issues as to where the limits should be, whether we do want to kind of push towards a kind of like no restrictions of freedom of expression, which even the most kind of vehement advocates for that, I think, would have problems. There's still a sense in which we must acknowledge the kind of harm principle, like what risk of harm can be brought by this expression. So yeah, I think that's something that we're still wrestling with, even amongst a kind of digital society in which we can access this material very easily online.
Do we know what happened to the director?
So the director, went on to make a few more commercial films. His follow-up film was called International Spy.
I see a theme emerging.
Yeah, so there was a sense in which, this was not a film that was kind of designed to kind of stoke tensions and kind of build a political movement. It was a commercial film capitalizing on whatever was kind of popular and interesting at the time. And then he went on to make a series of more kind of commercial films that were fairly successful.
Please join me in thanking Ian Robert Smith.